Sounds good.
Hello.
Hello.
Would you please start by telling me your full name, the date, the time, and your location?
Sure. So I'm Kirsten White. It is April 8th, 2021. It is 5:06 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and I am in Toronto, Ontario, Canada.
And do you consent to having this interview recorded, digitally uploaded, and publicly released under a Creative Commons license, attribution, non-commercial, share alike?
I do agree, yes.
And would you please start by introducing yourself to anyone who might find themselves listening to this? What would you want them to understand about you and the place that you're speaking from?
For sure. So, again, my name's Kirsten. I'm a pansexual white female colonizing Toronto. I'm a commercial producer and a psychotherapist in training. I also play hardcore and metal music and front two bands in that genre. I'm a staunch feminist and a supporter of Antifa and love all living, breathing things.
I'd like to start by asking you what the word pandemic has come to mean to you.
Pandemic to me has come to mean isolation, loneliness, separation from community. At the same time, it's meant coming together as a larger group to hopefully keep all of us safe. It also means a very quick stop to all of the things I used to do, and sort of a refinding of what it means to be me without all of the extracurriculars that would normally occupy my time.
To the extent that you're comfortable sharing, what were some of your experiences like with regard to health and healthcare infrastructure prior to the pandemic?
Prior to the pandemic, I'm very lucky to live in Canada. We have a free healthcare system, so a socialized healthcare system where everybody can have access. I personally have been in and out of hospital a lot over the years with mostly sports-related injuries and one car accident. I had felt and still feel that it is a bit of a rushed system. We are overburdened. We were overburdened pre-pandemic. The ability to care for people was sort of within the hour, hour and a half in which they'd want you in and they'd want you out of whatever system, whatever, whether you're at the hospital or you're with your GP, it's a very limited amount of time. So it does take quite a bit of time and resources in order to fully heal from things. I have also felt like I've experienced some sexism within the health field, where my problems specifically, whether it was reproductive health or mental health, were not necessarily taken as seriously. And I felt like I had to really advocate and fight for myself to get that kind of care that I needed. I feel like the system's set up to deal with, injury that is seen and not necessarily the invisible pain or injuries that other people suffer or that we all sometimes suffer with. So that's always been a hard thing to sort of swallow as a Canadian, is to see our healthcare system not necessarily take mental health or maybe neurodivergence or anything along with people who are just differently able, but it's not necessarily visible seriously with their concerns or with what's ever bringing them to a doctor. So that was my pre-pandemic experience. I also had a family member who in the early 2000s became my ward provincially. He fell down a flight of stairs and cracked his skull open due to some alcohol and drug-related issues, and just the care he received in that setting, again, just sort of dealt with trying to get him in and out as quickly as possible, and I didn't really feel like left him with much support post that problem. Lucky for me, he did regain full faculty, and so he was no longer legally my, I was no longer legally responsible for him, but the aftercare that he received was almost zero, other than suggestion of going to Alcohol Anonymous, which he never accessed, and just sort of has silently suffered. I mean, he's been drug and alcohol free since then, but silently sort of suffered with his addiction since the early 2000s, which was really painful to watch and still affects him to this day. So
I want to thank you so much for sharing that. Pre-pandemic, what was your day-to-day looking like?
My pre-pandemic life was very busy. I work, as I mentioned, I'm a commercial producer, so that's sort of a you wake up and when the job's done is when it's done sort of job, but definitely not a traditional 9-to-5. I would travel all over the world for that job, Italy, Romania, South America. On top of that, I had started school, so I was training to become, or I am training to become a psychotherapist, so Monday nights and Wednesday nights would be class, the weekend would be class as well. And then Tuesdays and Thursday nights, I would play in one or the other of my bands. And split and sprinkled throughout that was getting to play shows all over Toronto, Quebec, and Northern Quebec, and getting to go to do festival season, which was always a fun time. It was a go lifestyle for sure. Never a dull moment before pre-pandemic. So.
And how have you been adapting your day-to-day living? I know it's been a long time since it started.
I mean, I think I'm still sort of fighting the adaption, to be honest. It's not a natural state to be so still for me. I have, tried my best to incorporate daily exercise, more time with my dog, more time with speaking to my family to try to balance work, which is still very much go all the time. I guess because there is the space to actually sit in the uncomfortableness that is the stillness, I've slowly started to sort of see it as a gift and maybe less of a feeling like an oppressive weight. For sure.
And what are some of the ways that you've adapted coming to meet your sort of day-to-day needs?
I don't know if I've fully met them yet, to be honest. There still seems to be this feeling of lacking, and I think for me that's really based in community and not being able to go out as often and support, whether it's through benefit shows or protests or actively sort of helping out specifically in the music and queer community. But I think just in that stillness and learning how to even, taking on meditation as a way to help with that stillness, that's helped with adapting. It's still very uncomfortable. I guess I don't know if I've fully adapted yet, to be honest. I mean, I don't go out. I'm home, all day. I order all my groceries. I order all my food. I try to have this almost no contact. The only person I see is my partner. I haven't seen, except for from a great distance, haven't seen any of my family members really, other than my brother. And just trying to do my part to not, as much as I want to be out and I want to be doing the things, understanding that it's for the better good to stay home and to stay solo. So,
would you be willing to share a bit more about what partnership has been like for you in the pandemic?
Yeah, partnership, that's a very interesting question. For me, it initially was, my partner works in construction, so he's deemed essential. And so he's out he's out working, you know, every day, 4 a.m. to 3 p.m. or whenever it is that whatever site he's on. So there was definitely some compromising and some discussions on deeper discussions on what is safety and what each of us feels safe with in advance of like at the beginning of the pandemic. I definitely wanted him to stay home. I wanted him to go on to CERB. I wanted him to not be in contact with anyone. I was very worried, very, very worried for everybody. And that was a very privileged place to come from as I can do my job online. And it didn't, you know, except for at the beginning of the pandemic when we all had to take a bit of a pay cut in order to sort of keep the company going, I was still able to earn and pay my bills. So we had to, you know, have that conversation where my privilege was pointed out to me, and through those more difficult conversations, we were able to find a more comfortable middle ground of what makes us both feel safe and what makes us both feel comfortable. And it kind of expanded our communication as well, because, you know, you don't really think about telling your partner who's going to be where when you go out. You just, I'm going out, I'll see you later, you know. And now it was like, this is the person I'm going to see, and these are the rules that we've all discussed, and these are what people are feeling comfortable and safe with, which at first I think made us both sort of feel like we were reporting in, or somebody was our boss in a way, but or each other were each other's boss in a way, like, what are you doing, where are you going? But it's gotten easier. I mean, there's still things that you know, like if he wants to go and do something that I don't necessarily deem safe, you know, we wait until he gets a COVID test and then we'll see each other. But I feel like it's a good test. It's a good test for couples or in any partnership. I mean, I've had the same conversations with my best friends. My brother and sister-in-law and I own property together. So we've all, you know, if we wanted to see each other up there, we all had to have those, you know, deeper conversations around each person's comfortability levels. And I think in some cases it just brought me closer to them because I felt like I knew them better. Those wouldn't necessarily be questions I would have asked pre-pandemic, so.
I'd be interested in hearing a little bit about what you remember regarding the beginning of the pandemic, initial reactions when you heard about it.
I was actually on, I was on vacation to write an essay, which is sort of how my life goes. So in order to have the time for school, sometimes I have to take time off to write. So I'd actually been offline and had been focusing on an essay I was writing for school, and through socials ended up seeing that friends in New York were posting about crazy lineups for toilet paper, and then friends in Toronto were noting that there was some sort of flu that was going around the city, and I definitely felt panicked. I felt like, you know, that movie Outbreak was like coming to life a bit. My first reaction was to go back to work and to figure out how I could help and what I could do and what we were going to collectively do and how we were all going to stay safe. So I definitely, my trigger reaction was to try to organize and find solutions. And when you're staring down the news cycle of uncertainty, it definitely was pretty anxiety inducing because there was no other than stay home, do nothing. Don't talk to anyone, don't touch anything. You know, the uncertainty started to become quite anxiety inducing to the point where I think I remember feeling like there was almost like a difference between the air outside of your house and the air inside of your house. And I, you know, had never had that thought before. Being scared of the outside was brand new. So that was definitely my first couple, maybe 10 days worth of reactions.
And how has that reaction changed over time?
I think you become a little bit desensitized. I mean, I think the putting on a mask, disinfecting your hands, washing your clothes when you get home from set have all become very habitual, so they don't necessarily seem out of the ordinary now. I did, however, notice the other day when I was quite engrossed in a podcast that I walked into my building without a mask on. I couldn't believe it. I was just, you know, shocked. I think the relationship out in public is a little different. People are very, like, there's not that same, I really like to stop and chat or pay a compliment or, you know, how's the weather, or did you, you know, just saying hello to my neighbors and saying hello to the people who walk up and down the street. And that's, I feel like, all but stopped. So that's, I've noticed people are much more into keeping to themselves, a little bit of self-preservation, where I'm like, oh, even 6 feet apart, can't we just wave? So that's where I'm at now.
So 2020 has been a pretty big year, and 2021 is also shaping up to be a lot. I'm wondering what some of the most significant issues have been on your mind across this period of time.
For me, the issue of our houseless population having absolutely nowhere to go to seek safe social distancing, and just the complete lack of the city's response to creating permanent housing for those who are in the houseless community who want it. And on top of that, like, going after the encampments, destroying the encampments, removing people from the tiny shelters that are being built to help them not freeze to death in the winter, has just, it's been my main focus for the last, I'd say, 8 months, 9 months. Whether it's raising money or awareness, or going to the actual, like, going down to the parks when the police are there to raid and putting my body between them and the encampment residents, like, that's, like, I just can't, am I allowed to swear?
For sure.
Okay, I just can't fucking believe it. Like, I can't believe we're treating our most vulnerable population, like, as if the, like, they're doing the parks or wherever there you can find respite wrong. Like, it just is fucked. They just served, last 2 weeks ago, they served all the encampment residents with an eviction notice, and then you would essentially get a $10,000 fine or a criminal record if you didn't vacate the parks. Well, who else is using the parks? Who needs the parks? It's a pandemic. Everyone's supposed to be in their house. Ontario has been in the longest lockdown order, I think, out of any province or maybe even any territory in North America, maybe even Europe. Like, we've been in lockdown or some version of lockdown since it began. So who's out using the parks? And what is wrong with our houseless population using the parks? 90% of our respites or drop-in centers or shelters have had outbreaks. And then the city was like, oh, well, we'll start to give you the hotels that are abandoned that no one's coming to. And then the hotels would have outbreaks, but they wouldn't tell the residents in the hotels that there were outbreaks. Like, just the complete lack and disregard for this community has been at absolutely the forefront of my daily consciousness, since I started to see the tents pop up in my local parks. Obviously, also, like, I mean, I have been a long time supporter of BLM, but it was like so too little too late, you know, this last June when it finally exploded and it became, you know, just like people queer wash things during June. They started everybody was blackwashing everything that they were doing. And I'm glad that was getting out there and everybody was creating some space for, you know, black activists, black artists, black entrepreneurs, black everybody to be the voices at the front. But I feel like it's since then sort of dissipated, and people feel like, especially the white community, you know, like, they got too tired to keep going. And so, again, keeping that awareness and keeping that conversation going has also been top of mind. My metal band released our album in June, and immediately we're like, all the funds for this forever are going to the Black Legal Action Fund. Like, it just, now is the time for us white folks to start stepping up and helping out and raising black voices and actually doing all the things that we say that we're going to do that we never seem to do, and the fight just ends up back on our black comrades' shoulders, and that's just no longer acceptable. So that's also been very top of mind.
And would you
to,
be?
How to keep doing my own, just how to keep doing my own learning too in that space, so.
Would you be willing to explain what queerwashing and blackwashing is for someone who might be listening?
Yeah, for sure. So, and I work in advertising, so I'm extra aware of it. It's essentially when a brand aligns itself with either like normally some sort of political or socialized movement, and they, you know, for the month of June in Toronto, it's Pride Month, and they'll all of a sudden TD will have, you know, Pride flags all over their stores, or they'll be noting that all of, like, for 1 cent out of every interaction online will go to, let's say, Rainbow Road. And it happens for that 1 month, and it makes them look really great. It makes them look like they're true allies with community, and then they do nothing else for the rest of the year. And every month they trot it out, whether it's Black History Month, whether it's Women's History Month, whether it's Black Pride, or like it's they essentially just slap the insert flag here for whatever movement it is, and say that they're supporting that, or that they've always been supporting that. When if you look a little deeper and you do a little research, you'll see that they just do it either for that month, or they've only ever done it once, or it's completely in reaction to whatever political or social movement is happening at the time. And it's disgusting.
I wanted to follow up something you had said about your work in with people without housing, and that was when you talked about putting your body in between. Because in that kind of protest, there is often a very physical relationship between those whose bodies are in between and the police trying to cross that threshold. Mm-hmm. Would you say something about if any of that changed under COVID, either in terms of the practice or even feelings and emotional relationships to what that means during a pandemic?
Oh, that's a great question. I mean, to personalize my own recognition of fear, that's actually only been something in my own personal work and with what I've been doing for school, that I've recognized that I didn't really, due to my upbringing, due to how I was socialized, like, to feel fear was never something that was useful or important, you know. So the last time that I went out and did this was before I had had this revelation, and to me, it didn't register because I wasn't fearful for myself. There was no fear for me. There was only fear for those around me, for those who, you know, if their house was ripped up, they literally have nowhere to go. So it didn't register. But I think in retrospect, if anything, because I was so angry that it was happening and more angry than usual because I've been locked up in my house for 8 months or whatever, I found myself even more willing to do it and even more disgusted with the police and even more like I kind of, this is just me, I kind of fucking dare you. I dare you to stick your hands on me. I dare you. And that, again, is a very privileged white thing to say. But I dare you to fuck with me. Because it was just at this point where it was like, I can't even imagine being a police officer and going to work every day and being like, yeah, my job has a purpose. Like, I just put down your baton, put down your gun, take off the badge, and walk to the other side with the rest of humanity and help us out. Like, that's what it feels like. And obviously, like, your body to the, body to the front for me, especially white bodies to the front, was something that was, like, had always been taught to me in terms of, like, protest etiquette and privilege etiquette in that sense. Like, the last person they're going to pepper spray is a white woman, especially a female presenting one. So, yeah, that's just all I know, I guess.
I'm curious, what does health mean to you?
Oh, health is definitely a system network. So, you know, if the mind and the body are not able to connect and able to communicate with each other, then one is not healthy. So if you're living in a situation where you're in constant fear, you know, your body isn't necessarily going to be able to communicate to your mind if your mind is repressing the feelings of fear. So for me, true health is the ability to be embodied and to know what's happening with the self.
What are some of the changes you think might be necessary for you and those around you to be able to achieve that version of health?
There's a lot of there's a lot of oppressive systemic systems out there that need to be dismantled. I mean, again, from my privileged position, what affects me most, I would say, is the patriarchal system. I mentioned that earlier with even my own healthcare, feeling like not heard, not understood, not taken seriously. I think the idea that productivity is attached to one's success or one's earnings is attached to one's success, that so obviously capitalism needs to be, you know, really looked at and dismantled. I think that's a very unhealthy system that affects all of us. And those who suffer the most are obviously, for the most part, are Black trans sisters. I don't think that true health can be achieved until some of those systems are broken down. And I guess the fastest way to do that is to take the money out of the heavy ends of the political system. So, like, let's say defunding the military or defunding the police and spreading those dollars around to healthcare, to mental health care, to housing, to all of those different systems that, from like a Maslow hierarchy of needs, actually help fix the base needs so that then people can actually look at the needs that are above that and start to achieve those as well, so that you can, you know, with safety comes the ability to reflect and actually look at the rest of your life instead of being constantly in fight or flight mode. So I think I just went on a bit of a tangent, but the way for me to achieve health is for those systems to change. Because I can only do so much work on myself. I can only do so much work in my community. Top-down change has to happen. Because those like unconscious constant knowing factors will forever be pushing, on all of us who are not white and male identifying. And those, you know, cause health issues that will be one things that were affected ourselves our entire lives, but then that we also pass down intergenerationally to all of our children after us. Someone's got to put a stop to it. That was a big, deep question, Kit. Sorry. I went all over the place there, but yeah.
I want to just take a second to affirm that in an oral history interview, there are no tangents. There is no rambling. Everything you have to say is of value.
Okay, great.
I'm wondering, in the more sort of parochial sense of COVID-19, how you perceive the current medical infrastructure to be handling this moment.
I feel horrible for our RNs, our doctors, our frontline care workers. I just, the relentless pressure of this invisible disease is just there was already problems with the healthcare system. There were already cracks. And now that they've released the like tsunami the pandemic is essentially a tsunami. And now we've literally just busted the levees and like we're trying to fix, you know, major problems with Band-Aids. Everyone's just like gushing blood, and we're like, put this Band-Aid on it, it'll be fine. So I think our system is brutally underprepared, brutally underfunded. It's considered the ultimate line of defense, and provincially our government is doing nothing to help our healthcare workers. Much more interested in, and the Ford government is much more interested in how they can keep business going. I put that in air quotes, than they are to do the things that our healthcare system specifically asked them to do, which is just shut it all down, give everybody universal income and paid sick days, and and nobody move for the next 28 days because our ICUs right now are at complete max, and the new variants are making it even worse because now people my age, 35 and younger, are coming in and need to be intubated, and you know, there's no stop, and the government's not doing anything to help with that. All of our ER doctors wrote a letter to the provincial government saying, please put the whole friggin' province into lockdown. And this was like 4 days after they were like, we're going to open patios, because Ford is more interested in business than he is in the fact that our healthcare system has flat out said, we don't have any more beds. They're like, we're building more field hospitals. That's great. We actually don't have the people to staff those field hospitals.
Would you tell me what safety means to you?
Safety is, I guess, just safety is different for everyone, but for me, it's a perceived lack of threat. Threat can be anything from income or lack of income, loss of income, to physical bodily harm, to there's so much stuff. Let me start again. What is safety to me? Safety is a lack of threat. It's the ability to be able to take the time for oneself if one feels reactive, and either self-soothe or soothe with others, which is really hard to do during a pandemic. So
there's been a quite narrow medical description of what safety means under COVID-19. Thinking of that narrow framework, and you did mention some of this in terms of negotiating with your partner already, but how have you been determining what feels safe for you and negotiating that with others around you?
So I, because of how I grew up with a lack of safety in a violent home, I am very hypervigilant to what is and isn't safe. It's also very much based on who the person, I've also realized during the pandemic, it's also very much based on who the person is and the level of trust I already have for them. So in terms of, which is really interesting, you look at all of your friends and you realize which ones of them you actually trust. You know, if you're like, let's go have a hang in the park, you know, there's certain people I would trust more than others now that I've realized to tell me the truth about how they're feeling or where they've been or what they've been doing. And, you know, with those people, I'm seemingly, not that I'm taking risk, but I'm willing to take risk to see those people or to be with those people. Or to clearly communicate my boundaries. Whereas certain people, I will just say no and won't even start to have the conversation around what is safe for me and what isn't. I've also realized that, like I think I mentioned earlier, like with the recent realization of repressing fear for myself, that admitting that to the people that I trust, I'm scared. This makes me scared. I don't feel that this is safe, has been really connective, and a very good practice in being vulnerable with those specific people that I trust to have those conversations with. So it's been a bit of a gift that way. I don't think I would have ever noticed that I didn't process fear unless I had to have sat in a very, you know, undeterminable amount of time of staying home and being under a lockdown and dealing with an invisible virus, all these unknowns create anxiety, and it eventually builds up to a point where you can't ignore it. And you can't ignore it with others. And so with safety, it's easier to communicate now those needs.
May I ask how you're feeling about the immediate future?
About the immediate future, I'm very worried. I'm very worried for the province I'm in right now. I'm very worried for the business first, people second mentality. So I'm just hyper aware of the just how much longer this is going to be and how many more people are going to be affected by it. It's very overwhelming and daunting and sad. I don't, even though we have the you know, the vaccinations being rolled out, it doesn't to me, just there's something about this now having happened, it doesn't to me feel like this will never happen again. To me, this now feels like as we, as like, our capitalistic market, capitalistic community puts more and more emphasis on dollar value and making money and less emphasis on people and living in the environment, we're going to obviously keep encroaching further and further into places that will put us into contact with more and more of these types of diseases. And we will just be in this kind of constant circular, this is such a bummer, it's a constant circular reaction to these types of possible threats in the future. Like, that's honestly how I feel. I feel like it's just going, this is just the first of many.
What are some of your desires for a longer term future?
Oh, so many desires. I mean, my first desire is, again, just our house's population in Toronto actually having housing built, permanent housing built in my city, so that we can, like, people who've lived here their whole lives can continue to live here and aren't pushed out by the gentrification. So that to me is my desire for Toronto to turn around in the next 8 months and go, you know what, instead of these 98 condos we're putting up, we're going to put up eight to 12, because I think it's only like, they only need to build like 2,500 units or something to like, to house everybody. It's like really not that many units. That'd be my desired long-term goal, is to see Toronto residents be able to stay in Toronto. Cause it's a really, you know, it's a very diverse and loving city. I've lived here my whole life. And didn't really realize how lucky I was until I would go, no offense to America, you know, go somewhere like Louisville or Kentucky and just be met with like so much whiteness and so much blatant aggression. Like, I can't imagine everyone I know carrying a gun. Like, it would just be insane to me. So I, you know, and Toronto is an even more magical place because it's an urban city, and I just wanted to stay. I don't want it to become so yuppie gentrified that nobody that actually is a creator or a creative or any of those things can't live here anymore. So, yeah. Affordable housing, that's my long-term desire.
You've been using the term houselessness throughout this. Could you explain that syntactic difference from what is often described as homelessness? Oh, and why you use it?
Well, it's. I feel like homelessness is like got a way more negative connotation. I guess I can't remember why. I mean, for me, houseless is just like, this is, you are without house. It's not like you are without home. Home is a wherever your heart is sort of thing, right? And this isn't something that people are without home. They're without house. And some people might, you know, there is a part of the population that are houseless that want to be houseless. They don't want to be without house. They don't want house, but they want home. They want a place that they can call theirs and feel safe and live the way they want to live. So to me, that's the difference.
I'm curious, what are some of the things that you've been doing to take care of yourself throughout the pandemic?
I mean, when it wasn't the winter, i.e. Toronto, Canada half the year, you know, taking myself down to the waterfront and sitting near Lake Ontario was quite healing. Making sure I take my dog for a good walk every day. Working out every day, yoga every day. Until I hurt myself a few weeks ago, but just making sure I was keeping my body moving and eating enough, eating well. I find some part of my stress responses are normally to stop eating, and unconsciously, obviously, that is an attempt to control what you cannot control. So to try to be aware of that and to nourish my body and be kind to my body in that way, and not unconsciously punish it because I can't control what's outside of it. So, and lots of games of Settlers of Catan with my partner. We figured out how to make a 4-person pack into a 2-person pack. So, just trying to get away from screens as much as possible and listen to myself, listen to my body. That's the kind of self-care. That's all I feel like I know how to do. I'm still learning.
This is my second last question. So we know we're in this sort of flurry of biomedical and scientific research. I'm wondering what research you think people in the humanities and the social sciences could be doing right now to help us understand this moment.
Well, I think studying the effects of stress on the body and the stress on the autoimmune system would be really important, and making that information something that is as common as the understanding of what to do when you get a cold, which is, you know, drink lots of water and rest. Like, what does one do to help with stress? How does one identify stress markers, and what does that do to the body long term? Like, I think including that and studying the amount of people going in to receive treatment and care for like spontaneous illness that has come up in the face of this stress, this chronic daily stress that we all live under with this pandemic. I think it's a time where we're going to have, this is like the time where you would have the most candidates to do the research with and to really make that part of the canon of conversation around total health.
So this is my last question. This has been an oral history interview, and I come to it as a historian with my own sort of historically located sets of assumptions. And one of the values historians of my generation typically have is that the values of our historical actors are really important, regardless of whether or not we agree with them, that paying attention to what people at a moment of time thought was important. I'm wondering if you could tell historians of the future what they shouldn't forget, what advice you would pass on to them.
Don't forget Maslow's hierarchy of needs. I feel like we could have avoided this entire pandemic if there weren't such imbalances of money and power all over the world that people have to go and seek alternative food sources further and further back into our natural spaces, which I feel like is just sort of like, if you haven't seen the movie Contagion, go rent it. Go watch it. It's a pretty good example. We could have avoided this if people's basic needs, so, you know, housing, food, security, if those things had been met, you know, we wouldn't be where we are right now. And I really, truly believe that.
I want to thank you so very much for everything that you shared today and your honesty and your vulnerability. And at this point, I just want to create some space that if there's anything you want to say that my questions haven't given you a space to say, presenting that to you here now.
I think the last thing I would say is just, you know, I hate when people say things like silver lining or what did you get out of it or how are you, you know, what can you reflect on? But reflection is really the best way to understand how you're feeling about any situation. And if you have the capacity and the ability to journal during these times, and to sit with yourself and really be honest, you know, you will find in that writing, you will find in that, you know, verbal expression, however it is that you want to do it, you will find the ways in which healing will work for you, or self-care will work for you, or, you know, just what you need in that moment. You have the answers. And so during this really intense and difficult time, just take a moment for yourself to sit in that silence and journal and let yourself be honest. Because repression of those things and not communicating them will just make everything worse in the long run.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Kim. Thanks for letting me. Sometimes I get there, sometimes I don't.
I think you definitely got there. I think this is great. Thank you.